Well, thank you very much for tuning in today. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's September 13, 2012, day four of the teachers' strike in Chicago, and no agreement yet. 30,000 teachers and support personnel walked off their jobs on Monday after months of negotiations with the city failed to produce a new contract. Chicago's school district, with 400,000 students, is the third largest in the country. Stacy Davis is the legislative and political director of the Chicago Teachers Union. She joins us now for a brief update. Stacy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Where do negotiations stand right now?
Right now they're at the table. If any of your listeners pay attention to the mainstream media, the city is still providing some disinformation. I was just updated probably about 10 minutes ago that there is movement, that they're finally negotiating and not trying to convince us not to strike and to go back to the school buildings. So there is real negotiation finally at the table, and we're pleased with that. But by no means are we at an agreement. Are we making plans to tell our members to go back to their classrooms? We're still negotiating.
As I understand it, you have 49 key issues that you want resolved and that are, in fact, the basis for negotiation. Six of those 49 have been resolved, but I'm told that these are the items that the union didn't really have. I mean, these are not top tier on the 49 demands, but that the non-monetary items are the sticking point for the union. What do you mean by the non-monetary items?
The non-monetary items, comes up that the city is messaging on is teacher evaluation. Teacher evaluation does not cost the city anything. We're just asking for a fairer way to manage this teacher evaluation. It's not about money. Actually, it's about making sure that the evaluation process doesn't lump our teacher into two categories. You're either a great teacher or you're a bad teacher. And the metrics that they've set up would make more of our teachers bad teachers. So that's certainly a sticking point. We know that the city plans to close at least 100 of our schools. That story broke yesterday in the Chicago Tribune. These were rumors that we have been hearing about for months. And so when you close a school here in Chicago, you fire everyone in there. And we don't have a recall policy. And that's very critical to maintaining a stable school environment, is to have people there with legacy and roots in that community. And if you don't have that, then you have a lot of problems. I remember a few years back, they turned around the school on the far south side of town, Finger High School, and one of the students was murdered by another group of students who went to the school or had at one point gone to the school. Now, obviously, there were some cues going on in that building before such a thing happened, but because over 90% of that staff was brand new, they didn't have a relationship with the students that were there to understand what was going on. We're working in a system right now where 40%, we started with in 2000, we have 40% of our teaching staff that was African American. Currently, it's halved. It's halved. Only 1.7% of our teachers are African American males. In a city that's over, in a school district that has 90% black and brown children, that clearly is a problem. You know,
on the monetary items, what so far would you say has been progress on that?
I would say that the monetary items, and this may sound slightly atypical of our labor negotiations, the monetary items, because we do recognize what we're dealing with here. We recognize the economic forecast, right? What's going on? We're in a recession. We get it. So that has been less of the sticking point. I know people have heard like this 30%. That's absolutely ridiculous. We get that. We are trying to maintain a framework in which teachers have been paid for the last 45 years that we don't think should be changed. It rewards experience and it rewards people who've developed their careers with extra class time, with extra degrees, and we don't argue that. That's just what it is. And so we're trying to maintain that, and we're also trying to make sure that we get cost of living, that we can absorb the higher health care prices, or they're frozen at some point. So those are, you know, those are some of the typical issues that go on in labor negotiations. But, you know, ours are, you know, different here in Chicago, because this is the birthplace of the neoliberalism agenda for public schools. This is the birthplace for it. So what you see here is that many of our schools are being closed down under the guise that they're failing the very students that they're supposed to help, right? So we've taken the historic inequities in our education system. We've taken the racist policies that have helped to breed, you know, overwhelming segregation here in Chicago, and made them the reasons why we fire teachers and close schools, when those are the very reasons why our schools are under-resourced and our children are not getting the type of education that they deserve, right? So here in Chicago, we give TIF money to United Airlines to move downtown. We give a tax break to the Chicago Board of Trade, but we have 160 schools without libraries, and those schools reside on the south and west sides of town, which are predominantly black and brown. We have schools that don't have playgrounds, over 100 of them. We have schools that have year-round classes in Chicago in the summertime, but they don't have air conditioning. But we're giving tax breaks to the Board of Trade. There is something seriously wrong when your mayor, who has full control of the schools, is taking advice from venture capitalists and hedge fund managers of how to run a school district. When Karen Lewis, our leader, is a nationally board certified teacher. She's a 20-year veteran. Her parents were teachers. You know, they're not speaking to people across the table who are what one may term union hacks. You're speaking to people across the table who are solid practitioners, who have great track records in the classroom, who understand the practical application of education. But that's not the point here. The point here is that we have a mayor who's known nationally as a Democrat. I saw him in Charlotte. You know, you would never know by the smile on his face that there was a teacher strike brewing back at home. I mean, locally here, we think of him as a Republican.
With the pace of things, you're back now at the table, the union and the city. Is there any expectation, given the pace of things having picked up today, that an agreement is within reach?
We have been pushing for an agreement for the last 9 months. We started this process in November 2011. The city did not come to the table to negotiate. The city came to the table to talk us out of a strike. They came with some of the most unreasonable issues. And so finally, when, you know, the rubber met the road and our teacher said enough, then we start negotiating. And so I would say that in the last few days, we've negotiated. So we've been doing this since November, and finally we're at the negotiating process. And we feel good about where things are going. But, you know, like I said, it's been 9 months. Our expectations have been raised and then lowered, you know, considerably. And there's an extraordinary lack of trust around that table as well. So we're moving because we want to get back into our classrooms. We want to make sure that our students are learning, you know, because that's why we do this. But we also have to make sure that our work environment, which, by the way, is the learning environment for our students, is one in which education can happen. You know, this push for standardized testing has just taken over the classroom. We estimate that about 30 days out of the school year is spent on test preparation and test taking. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous.
I want to come back to a phrase that hit me because of it actually is a lead-in, as it were. I mean, it's unintentional, but it is a lead-in to our next discussion. You referred to the strike and you referred to the city as a birthplace of the neoliberal agenda. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, you have Democrats here in Chicago, our mayor being one of them, that should embrace the working person, that it's supposed to be the party for people who have been alienated economically and socially. So here, though, they take your issues, so your social issues, your social marginalization, and they say, you know what, we got a plan for you. We can help you, right? And then they bring us in, and there's no help there. You know, we've gone charter crazy in Chicago. We've gone charter crazy in Detroit. We've gone charter crazy in Philadelphia. We've gone charter crazy in New Orleans, Louisiana. And what we know here in Chicago, what we know nationally, is 1 in 6 of those schools work. And that's after they've taken out every student that they think can achieve. And they're still not beating the neighborhood school that takes all in the attendance boundary, regardless of parental participation, regardless of test scores. We have special education students, English language learners, who are not being embraced by the charter school movement. Not at all. So what happens to the education of those students? Well, they have to come back to the neighborhood schools, which are woefully underfunded. I mean, our Board of Education here, you know, it's not ran by people who, you know, are natives to this community that understands, you know, the historical ramifications of inequity. You know, what I find very interesting on a historical level, because I was a history teacher, I am a history teacher and have been for the last 12 years, is that in 1963, parents and students stayed home intentionally for the first 2 days of school to protest the under-resourcing of education, the poor conditions under which they had to learn. And fast forward to 2012, we're in the same situation, but they keep telling us that they're helping us. You know, I'm reminded of a quote, and I may mangle it somewhat, but I think Malcolm X would said it best. He said that the mainstream media will have you believing that your enemies are your friend and your natural allies are your enemy. And that's the type of messaging that we're dealing with here in Chicago. You know, he held our mayor, Mayor Emanuel, he held a press conference about the teacher strike once the teacher strike was declared on Sunday night. He held a press conference at the Harold Washington Library. And next to him, on the right of him, was the police superintendent. Nowhere in sight was the superintendent or the CEO of schools. The lead educational person in the city was nowhere in sight until they called him from the sideline somewhere to say something for 5 seconds. But that entire press conference, while our mayor held court, he stood next to a police officer. That has profound implications in the system that's 90% black and brown. It has profound implications in a system where the U.S. Department of Education conducted some research and found that Chicago has the highest rate of suspensions and expulsions for African-American males in this entire nation. And you stand next to a police officer when you're speaking about schools? That's a neoliberal agenda. Our kids are being carted off to prison at unprecedented rates. You look at the prison system and you see black and brown students. I mean, I know I'm taking some liberty here on your show, but these issues have far-reaching impact. We have destabilized neighborhoods. They don't have the anchors anymore. They have these schools where only 25% of those people who live in that neighborhood attend them. That's what we get with charter schools. So where do the other 75% of the neighborhood go? Where it just defies logical sense, common sense. You know,
well, Stacey, what I do is, of course, we're going to be focusing on this because it is worthy of very deep study, because you're correct. It is serving as instruction for a number of things to come, not just in Chicago, but all across the nation with respect to the public school system, but also, and particularly I will point this out, with respect to the overwhelming number of black and brown children in the public school systems of America. So thank you for joining us today. We'll come back to you and others and decipher process of bargaining with the city, but also talking about the educational imperatives that this strike is trying to get across the nation. Thank you so much for your time today.
We'll come back.
We'll still be in Chicago when we right after this. Well, thank you. We just had a little glitch there, but it's been fixed. We're back. You're listening to Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. The teachers' strike and the political scenario unfolding in Chicago are a somber backdrop for a political dynamic that we seldom address, and that is liberalism and its impact on Black politics. Luckily, we have an eminent political instructor who can put things in perspective for us. He's Professor Michael Dawson, who is the John D. MacArthur Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago and the founding and current director of the university's Center for the Study of Race, Politics, and Culture. Dr. Dawson's research interests have included the development of quantitative models for African-American political behavior, identity, and public opinion, the political effects of urban poverty, African-American political ideology, and democratic theory. He has authored several award-winning books on Black politics, including Not in Our Lifetimes, The Future of Black Politics, Black Visions, The Root of Contemporary African-American Political Ideologies, Behind the Mule, Race and Class in African-American Politics, and Blacks in and Out of the Left, Past, Present, and Future. And his next book is on Reflections on Black Politics in the 21st Century. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Dawson, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Stacey Gates of the Teachers Union that we just finished a brief update with talked about liberalism. In fact, she said that the strike in Chicago and Chicago Now has become the birthplace of a neoliberal agenda. Liberalism happens to be a sore point with you, too. In fact, in your books, you repeatedly cite liberalism as a bay to Black political, social, and economic power and progress. Could you explain?
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to make a fairly strong distinction between liberalism as an ideology, which is vast and claims that include everything from some versions of social democracy to libertarians on the right, and neoliberalism, which I think is a major problem both within Black politics, although not usually recognized as such, and certainly within the country as well. And I think your last guest was quite correct in saying that what we see in Chicago today and reflected in the Chicago teacher strike is a neoliberal regime at the head of a major American city. And what I mean by neoliberalism, there's two parts of it. One is a set of policies, which include, over the last 20 years or more, free trade policies, which often have led to the relaxation of environmental, occupational safety, and labor laws and protections in many countries. It includes the deregulation of particularly financial sectors, which we have seen the results of over the last 3 or 4 years. It includes the shrinking of government at a massive rate, and part of that is the dismantling of the welfare state in the U.S., Western Europe, and elsewhere. It also is the concentration, the globalization of finances, again, with results that we see now, particularly in countries such as Spain and Greece and others that are on the cutting edge of the troubles with the euro in the world economy. The other part of neoliberalism is illogical. Part of it is the belief that all institutions should run by market principles, whether they're prisons, educational institutions, artistic institutions, that have very little to do with profit-making activities, but they still, according to neoliberal ideology, should be run on market principles. It also means that politics should take a back seat. So neoliberals often argue that we should turn to market solutions, turn away from politics. To the degree that we talk about politics, we should not talk about mass social movements. We should really reduce politics to just infrequent elections every few years, and that's all we need for a democratic society. And neoliberal ideology also includes the belief that if there are those in society who are not doing well, it's their fault or their group's fault. It has very little to do with the nature of the economic system or the political system. So neoliberalism is a set of ideological beliefs and a set of policies that have been instituted worldwide and embraced worldwide by many elites. And certainly we have seen results of that in a marked change in particularly black political leaders moving from a more social movement orientation, even those who are elected officials, to those who are much more technocratic and much more embrace a neoliberal conception of politics, government, and the economy.
What's the difference between liberalism and progressivism?
Liberalism, excuse me, what was the second part?
And progressivism.
Well, progressivism has meant different things in different parts, different times in American history. But in this period, I think progressivism is composed of those who believe that the state still has a role, for example, in regulating the economy, that the state has a role in and it should be a societal concern to eliminate inequalities of various sort, particularly economic inequality, a belief that indeed we have a joint responsibility to each other and that we should not necessarily live purely by market-based values and procedures. So that embraces a very wide progressivism embraces a very wide range of concerns, including those concerned with sustainability, the environment, those who want to eliminate sexism and homophobia. So progressivism is a set of overlapping movements and concerns that are generally, but not exclusively, identified with what used to be known as the left.
How do you see liberalism, or neoliberalism, as you express it, rearing its head in Chicago's current political scene right now?
Well, one of the reasons, I think, is the move in the Democratic Party nationwide toward a neoliberal agenda, and the Democratic leadership of the DLC, which produced Clinton, which embraced President Obama, which saw it as its mission for over a decade to move the Democratic Party to the right, if they call it to the center, which what that meant to the right, was to move the Democratic Party in a way that made the Democratic Party look much more like the Republican Party of the late 1960s or the early 1970s. So what part of the move of the Democratic Party was to rethink how it thought about politics, rethink how it thought about the welfare state, rethink about how it thought about the responsibility of the party or the, more generally the nation toward dealing with society's problems and inequality and an embrace of the much stronger base of the corporate sector and putting unions more at a distance, really only working with unions when it came time to mobilize their memberships for campaigns. So what we see in Chicago now is the former chief of staff of the Obama administration, an administration that by and large has embraced neoliberal ideology and policies, take over the city of Chicago. But to be fair to Mayor Emanuel, the previous mayor also embraced the same policies, even though he came out of a different political tradition, a family that had a different political tradition, a much more old-fashioned political machine. But the son of the original Mayor Daley also actually was, in many respects, governed on a neoliberal basis in the Chicago for a very long time.
One of the tenets of politics is that the basis on which you are oppressed is the basis on which you organize. What has happened in Chicago, where you have such a large population of African Americans who nonetheless have been absorbed into a party that, for the most part, as you point out, has been operating right of center? What is preventing African Americans in Chicago from organizing around the basis on which they are being discriminated and oppressed.
I would point out that Chicago has a large black community. It's a very large Latino community. It has a very large working class community. It's all communities that should, on paper, be unhappy with the current regime. I think there's a couple things that have happened. One is that for a lot of groups that were liberal or progressive in their political orientations, like African Americans, they've been demobilized. They have been demobilized in Chicago now ever since the death of Harold Washington decades ago. So we see a community that's disorganized. Two, we also see what the former mayor was extremely good at, and which the current mayor and the Democratic Party has been good at, is a co-opetition of elites from these communities. So you see a lot of upper middle class organizers, elected officials, business elites, and even some public intellectuals from black communities, from brown communities, also incorporated into the Democratic Party and also incorporated more specifically into the being allies of the mayor. So the third thing we've seen is since the dismantling of Jim Crow is a sharpening of class politics within black communities. So that, for example, when we think about school policy, it's often the case that we find a division in the black community between working class parents and upper middle class parents. Upper middle class parents support the magnet schools, support the charter schools. Their children often benefit from the public school system. While we've had school fights over schools and neighborhood schools in Chicago, which saw upper middle class black parents on one side and working class parents from the neighborhood on the other side. So the fact that you have unmasking of class tensions within black communities is also, I think, has undercut the political efficacy of what could be a progressive black politics.
What do you see as the most effective opposition tactic to neoliberalism?
Well, I think part of it at the beginning has to be two things. One is educating people part of what I think has happened in the country as a whole, and certainly among black communities and other progressive community, is a belief that the Democratic Party is all we have. And that, or as unsatisfactory as the Democratic Party may be, as disappointed as people may or may not be, or often are with the Obama administration on multiple policy issues, the alternative is far worse. That said, what we have failed to provide is the type of programs, organizations, particularly at the local level, that can provide a viable alternative to, let's say, the Democratic Party of Rahm Emanuel. And the only way that can be done is the hard work that takes more than a year or two, and takes probably more than an electoral cycle, a building of independent organizations that can hold these, particularly initially local and statewide officials, responsible and insist that they respond to the concerns of their constituents, which is not happening now.
To what degree would you say that the neoliberal agenda is evidenced even in left-of-center movements in the United States?
Well, I think you certainly see some aspects of neoliberal politics and left-of-center movements. For example, some unions are having fights about to what degree, who do we want to organize? Do we want to protect our traditional membership? Do we want to organize the undocumented? Do we want to organize those who have been previously organized? To what degree do we want to form alliances with progressive community groups? So I think we see to what degree do we want to support various types of regional trade policies? So I think we see the influence of neoliberal politics in directly in some ways in terms of the fights we have with some left organizations or progressive organizations such as unions. But we also see it in organizations like the Civil Rights Movement, where instead of mobilizing the community to make demands, we've gone instead toward a lobbying model there. Instead of organizing people to make demands on governments or on corporations, what we want to do instead is go to Washington and act like any other K Street firm, and that will lobby members of Congress, will lobby people in the various bureaus and departments of government. And so instead of having a mass mobilization model of politics, instead we have a lobbying model of politics, and that very much fits the neoliberal conception of the narrowing of politics and demobilization of masses of people and communities.
The number is 1-888-874-4888. 1-888-874-4888. Our guest is Professor Michael Boston, the John D. MacArthur Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. We're talking about things neoliberal today. We'll come back with this very short music bump.
To lead stories, we're having quite a bit of trouble, but we're trying to sort it all out. This sometimes happens on the internet. Dr. Dorson, are you with us?
I'm back, yes.
Okay, I'm very sorry. We're having some issues and we're working on getting them fixed. So we may just have to have you back and complete this discussion once again. But so far, how do you read the situation with the current political climate as we head toward, you know, the general election itself?
I think pretty strongly that what we see is a country that is as polarized as it has been since probably the 1960s. We also see a country where multiple populations are extremely disenchanted with the government, with American society, with the economy. Often for different reasons. I think everyone is disenchanted for the economy and the lack of growth in everything other than the financial markets. But there's other reasons that, for example, Latinos are disenchanted with the punitive and often racist policies that are happening at the state level and a lack of movement at the national level in immigration reform. And also, I think what we're seeing is a ugly political mood where we're seeing a type of rhetoric and lies about what's going on politically, economically, socially in the United States that we haven't seen for quite a long time. So I think we're specifically in terms of the election is that even though it looks like the president is slightly ahead, this is an election where I think anybody who's honest, who's a professional, says we really don't know what's going to happen. There are some really wild scenarios that are at this point feasible.
Why does it seem to be so threatening to, well, to the general populace that African Americans or Latinos or Asians or any particular group would want to organize specifically on the basis on which they believe they are oppressed? Why is this so threatening?
Well, part of it, I think, is that there's been, in this case, literally billions of dollars put into a message saying that these groups are a threat. From the super PACs are putting out that message. Russ Limbaugh is putting out that message. Glenn Beck is putting out that message. Pat Buchanan wrote a book that was popular in those circles, which claimed that white men built this country and everything good in this country was built by white men, and that it's being taken away from them. And so the slogan, "We want our country back," or "that we built this," is just this mildly cleaned up versions of this view that, which I consider essentially white supremacist and patriarchal, that one group and only one group has any claim on this country, and that group is now being unfairly pushed aside because of, and this is, of course, all this
in quotes,
being pushed aside by the hordes coming across the border or the lazy people in the ghettos. That's the message we're getting, and among some quarters, unfortunately, it's taking hold. And it plays into long, centuries-old stereotypes about non-white populations in this country and being the dangerous other.
So is the future of black political power literally in the hands of some other entity, some other party other than its own?
There's a fear of political and economic power being in the hands of anybody other than the people who have had it for years. And the belief that you cannot have difference in a democratic country at the same time, a democratic small b, a democracy, that diversity and democracy do not go together, is the message that's being heard. And that we have the only way we can preserve this country. I'm sorry, you're breaking. The connection is breaking up again.
Oh boy! As we look at the Democratic Party and the platforms and the planks of its platform and so forth, we see that it is able to pay attention to many constituencies that are organized and that have, in fact, pressed its demands on the party, and the party shows the ability to respond. I don't get a sense that for the African American community that is happening.
That's not happening. It's not happening for, I think, a particular reason, which is that the leadership of the Democratic Party feels that the African Americans have no other place to go. They do not have to be responsive in order to get black votes, because African Americans will not vote for the Republican Party. And that, they're right. The gamble they're making, it might be a gamble that burns them in November, is that it's still the case that African Americans, when dissatisfied, can stay home and not vote for anyone, and they're counting on that not happening. We'll see whether that's a good gamble or not.
Given that the stakes are so high, I know that, you know, everybody is geared toward the presidential election, but it seems just to be the case, and I think you make the case for this in your books, that there has to be a serious effort at organizing once more, because as Stokely Carmichael, the late Kwame Ture, used to say, power is the organized masses. What is the difference in Chicago between now and when Harold Washington was there? What accounted for the difference in political behavior within the African American community?
One was a leadership that had much more grounded roots in the poorer and more disenfranchised segments of the black community, including Harold Washington himself, who came out of the labor movement. Two was the city, and particularly the black population, was much more organized on a grassroots level than it is today and had the capacity to mobilize. That's what we've lost over the last 30 years, is that both a leadership that has ties to the press sectors of the community, and the community itself being organized and able to insist on its own demands and its own agenda being respected and responded to by the cities and, for that matter, regional and national leaders.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Professor Dawson. I know we had quite a bit of a challenge technologically, but we are trying to cope with those. We want you back because your topic is very insightful. The research that you have done in this area is very relevant, and I think it needs to be shared. Across the board, it needs to be shared, because even within the so-called progressive communities, the left-of-center communities, there is a reluctance to confront the internal contradictions that prevent moving ahead and dealing with the overarching problems. You know, the question is, how do we situate ourselves in a large agenda but still believe that it is predicated on the component parts being absorbed, that they leave behind their identities and lend themselves to this amorphous thing called a movement. All movements still have component parts, and it is important, given the history of the United States, that these component parts have their own unique voice, and without anybody being threatened, without anybody being insecure. So I think that's one of the things that your work has done, which is to give a very firm footing, a very good historical background for the ways in which black politics has developed in the United States. So thanks so much for being with us, and you certainly will ask you back to do this interview in a more extended way. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, and I look forward to coming back.
Thank you. Well, that concludes our program today. Like I said, we had a bit of a technological trouble, but we'll rectify that. It's out of our hands. These things happen. And we're all grown. We can handle it. We certainly can. I want to thank you so much for your warm welcome and your wonderful messages of encouragement and support. And I want to thank you also for the level of contribution that you make to this program, where everybody can learn something and bring something and engage in public discourse in a way that is very different from the norm. I really thank you for that. If you want to reach me at Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com, leadstories@gmail.com. I'd be delighted to hear from you and to continue this conversation. But in the meantime, let me thank you for today, and we will connect again with each other tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on the Progressive Radio Network. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.